Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara, and Happy New Year. This is going to be a program about kind of looking back on the really big headlines of the art world and collectible antique world, and you know what we actually are keeping our eye on for 2026. One of the really interesting stories that came out very late in December was a history of the Doge's Palace in Venice. And, you know, this is the palace. If you've been to Venice, dear listener, you know that the Doge's Palace, you know, goes back before the 10th century. And, you know, it's been through all kinds of vicissitudes, not the least of which was in the 10th century was it was set on fire by a rebellious mob who didn't like the city leadership. And then in 1483, flames spread through the eastern wing, and that was part of the palace that housed the Doge's private residence. And then the damage that the fire rendered by 1574 had not been repaired when another fire broke out. Well, the third blaze proved to be the worst. It threatened the structural integrity, the foundations, etc., and it spread to the Great Council Chamber Room. Now, that was a room that could seat thousands of people. It was huge. And it was filled to the brim with highly valuable, flammable paintings from the finest artists of the Italian peninsula at the time. So, you know, we can talk a little bit about what burnt up, but just to give you a little background, the Doge's Palace in Venice was built atop a construction site that dates back to the fall of the Western Roman Empire in 500 AD. And it's partially Gothic, Renaissance, and Mannerist. And then part of that was the Doge's Palace, Palazzo Ducale. And it's the largest building. If you've been to Venice, it's the most impressive historic buildings in all of Italy. And it was the headquarters of the Venetian Republic's government and the government's elected leader, which was the Doge. So the Doge had quarters, I should say, that rivaled the popes of Rome and rivaled Florence's Medici family in wealth and power. And the Doge over time, there's many Doges over that time in Venice, but each Doge commissioned well-known artists to create paintings and sculptures that demonstrated the Venetian Republic's might. The general collection in its entirety was lost in the fire of 1577, it turns out. But the palace still, you can go inside and visit. The palace in Venice remains one of Italy's foremost treasure troves of medieval and Renaissance art. Recent facts are emerging about the 1577 fire, and the historical account focuses on the workers that were tasked with extinguishing the flames. And the temperature inside the building caused the leaden roof to liquefy and rain down upon these poor workers. And this was, you know, a tragedy because the lead itself was supporting a painted ceiling fresco that was said to have depicted paradise. Portraits of the past Doges adorned the hall of the chamber. Titian's work, for example, forever lost in these fires, you know, fires. As we well know, that's pretty much the end of story. Tintoretto, an influential contemporary of Titian, There were two paintings of Frederick the First, the Holy Roman Emperor, in the 12th century, also lost. Carpaccio painting, lost. Pisanello, Bellini, Veronese, all these artists lost in 1577. What the Venetian government did in 1578 was reintroduce a decoration program, and they wanted story paintings this time, stories that tell the growth of Venice's rise to power. So if you go to the Doge's Palace today, you're going to see that, the history paintings on the ceiling of the Doge's Palace. Just an amazing story, things that are resurfacing after, you know, 500 plus years. I want to talk about a public art masterpiece. It's called Ruckus Manhattan. This is an installation that's a 50-year-old installation by an artist, Red Grooms, and it's an immersive installation, and it's back on view at the Brooklyn Museum. And what is it? Well, it's an installation, as I said, so it's parts of sculpture, and there's the centerpiece of the sculpture is a ferry boat, Marine and Aviation, City of New York, yellow ferry boat, large. And it is on stylized waves, which are black billowing pieces of fabric. And this was the piece entitled Ruckus Manhattan, one of the most ambitious public art projects of the 20th century. It occupied in 1975 a vacant lobby space of an office building in New York's financial district. It was monumental, it was hyper-detailed, it was a recreation of some of the city's landmarks, etc. And it, like I say, it was a huge lobby filled with this big installation. And then it was stored for 50 years. Well, the Brooklyn Museum is remounting this. And this particular Ruckus Manhattan is recreated by an artist in a slightly smaller scale. And this is actually an artist, Mimi Gross, who was one of the creators in the original piece. And now she is overseeing a team of 20 to 30 artists redoing this littler version of Ruckus Manhattan in paper mache and wood and fiberglass and plaster. And they actually originally put this in, I think I was telling you, a vacant lobby of a building designed by I.M. Pei, famous architect, just a few blocks from Wall Street. What does the display entail? It's Ruckus Manhattan. It's images of Manhattan. There's a massive subway car, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Rockefeller Center ice skating rink, the Woolworth Building, a mechanical dragon. Well, the Twin Towers are there because at the time, 50 years ago, they were just 2 years old at the time. And they have a World Trade Center sculpture or two. The tightrope walker that, remember, 50 years ago, an image of him. All kinds of interesting things that go on, you know, a bookstore installation, for example. A famous bookstore facade is up there, too. It's a sculptor pictorama. That's the name of what it's being created or recreated there. And, you know, this was a partnership between a married couple in 1975, Red Grooms and Mimi Gross. They were married from 1964 to 1976. And their marriage began with a traveling puppet show across Italy in 1961 in a horse-drawn carriage painted by Mimi Gross. They did many sculptural installations. Big ones. One was called City of Chicago, 1967, a massive work depicting stylized versions of the city's famous landmarks in Minneapolis. There was a big installation called Discount Store at the Walker Art Center, and Astronauts on the Moon, a big installation at the Guggenheim, New York. All this is all in the 70s. And Ruckus Manhattan was sort of the creme de la creme because all the little details were there. For example, they had little actual bones in the Trinity Church graveyard and lighting that brought the work to life at night. So this is, at the Brooklyn Museum right now. So if you're planning a New Year's trip to the Brooklyn Museum, you got to take a look at the spectacle that is in miniature that was Ruckus Manhattan. You just you have to see the combination of things. Two works are out and on display along with Ruckus Manhattan, the Staten Island Ferry that we talked about, and then the 42nd Street Porno Bookstore. The peep shows and porn shops, etc. This is also a marker of the 200, oh, sorry, 401st anniversary of New York City in 2026. The installation was put together by a whole group of artists under the direction of Mimi Gross, and this is actually a challenge to create and preserve because the funding ran short. And the Citizens Committee for New York paid money to organize the reconstructure of this Ruckus Manhattan. Fantastic story. Take a look. If you're going to go to Brooklyn, take a look at Ruckus Manhattan. A lot of the elements were displayed outside, some at the Museum of Outdoor Arts in Colorado. Some were displayed at the Allen Memorial Art Museum at Oberlin College. So the team of artists is reconstructing what was once the original Ruckus Manhattan. So that's a kind of an interesting story about how an artwork from the 70s is being reconfigured, restored. And by the way, I have a prediction. I think 1970s is going to be the buzz time in 2026. People that knew the 70s find that hard to believe, but I think that the art world is really starting to see the resurgence of things and artists that really made a mark for themselves in the 1970s. It was a real formative period. And I think that the 1970s was not what we think of in terms of the kind of neon colors, and there was some really interesting work happening, and it was poo-pooed for a while, but I think it's back. So I want to talk a little bit about the latest well, the latest Art Basel in Paris. This is a artist that sold for quite a bit of money at that particular Art Basel. A female artist, and I want to talk about some of the recent scholarship around her, Marie Brachmond. And she was actually quite a beautiful artist. You can see her in the collection of the Musée des Beaux-Arts at the de la Ville de Paris. And in her lifetime, she was obviously an impressionist painter. She was painting circa 1880 or so. She had high critical acclaim and patronage, and she was shown in prestigious exhibitions of impressionist work, and one of the few female impressionists. Well, what happened was her husband said, I really don't think you should paint. And not only that, I don't think you're a very good painter. His persistent criticism pushed her to retire early, and she died in 1916. Lamented as one of the artists who should not have been ignored. And then eventually it was predicted that her talent will come back and surprise those in the future. Oh, well, a century later, she is now receiving some serious recognition. The Walker Art Gallery in Liverpool has just acquired a canvas by her, and the market for her work is really growing. And the people who love her work who was she? This is an exciting moment for female artists in Impressionism. We have women who painted before 1900. And the art world, here again, a prediction for what's going to happen in 2026. I think the art world is going to reassess the narratives of art history through marginalized artists. And I think we have an instance here of Marie Bracamonte being rediscovered in 2025, 2026. She was born in 1840 in Brittany, and she grew up the child of an unhappy marriage. She kind of lived between a number of households in France and Switzerland. She was kind of a rebellious teenager. She began taking painting lessons, and she actually was accepted in 1850s by the Paris Salon. And she entered the schools of some of the great painters of Paris at the time. For example, Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres, who took her under his wing and invited her to train at his Paris studio. And Ingres said that he wasn't sure she had the courage, as she was a woman in the field of painting in the future. And so, you know, at the time, dear listener, a teacher as famous as Ingres said, okay, Bracamonte, you will be painting flowers and fruits and still life and genre scenes. She left Ingres' studio and she made her own way. And she was a portrait artist for a while. And she painted some amazing female portraits in court, including those of the court of Empress Eugenie, the wife of Napoleon III. Remarkable work of some of the female wives and leaders of nations at the time. And then she was also beginning in 1880 to paint plein air and spontaneously working outside. And this influenced her work as well. It's just a kind of an interesting story. Overlooked since actually the 1880s, she's getting looked at again, and the values are high and the museum acquisitions are high.
Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart.
Okay, now here's one that I know you'll smile at. Okay, so there was a gentleman that was an artist that made some incredible things, Marcel Duchamp. And the story that has just recently been discovered is that back in 1919, Marcel Duchamp, who, by the way, was the originator of ready-made art. What was that? Remember the toilet, for example, that hung on the wall? That was ready-made by Duchamp. So ready-made art, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But in 1919, he decided, he didn't have cash on him. But he decided that he was going to pay his dentist by check. And 1919 checks were not as reliable. And Marcel was really, really good with pen and ink. And he decided to make a forged check entirely by hand. And this is a check that actually has passed through the annals of art history. And we're going to surprise you in this story by telling you what it sold for. This is a check that was created for Marcel Duchamp's dentist. Daniel Zenk was his name. Dentist Zenk. And the work is called Zenk Check, 1919. Well, the dentist had recently done some work on Marcel Duchamp's teeth. And he had just moved to New York. This was an American dentist. And he had moved from New York to Paris. And that is because a frenzy was met by that same sculpture that I talked about called Fountain, which was a toilet in 1917. Oh, yeah, he was run out of Paris, but he was embraced in New York. There was a lot of avant-garde artists in New York in 1917, Man Ray, et cetera. And so, you know, Duchamp visited this dentist in 1919, and the check is made out for $115. That's a lot of money in 1919. And it's drawn on the account of the Teeth Loan and Trust Company Consolidated, to Wall Street, New York. Okay, there is a contrast between, it looks like a check, like a check at the time. And there's a contrast between the printed text, the stamp number, which marks it as check 4864, and the vertical red text announcing it as an original, and then the handwritten text, which is the date and the artist signature. Okay. Did Duchamp figure, okay, I'm going to fool the dentist into thinking this is really money? Or did Duchamp think, just like Picasso many times has said, anything I sign is going to be worth more than money one day? I don't know what he was thinking, but suffice to say, the check still remains today. And the question is, was the dentist Zenk fooled? Okay. The dentist never cashed the check. Well, he couldn't. I mean, it was drawn on what was the title of the bank it was drawn on. The Teeth's Loan and Trust Company Consolidated. Well, you know, you couldn't cash the check. And also, the dentist was in the know about the artist. He kind of knew that Marcel Duchamp was an absolute, either was going to be a Looney Tune for life or a great artist, one of the two. And the artist, in fact, was both. But the dentist was also a collector and patron of avant-garde art. That is strange, I gotta say, because my dad was a dentist. The last thing he'd want to buy, last thing he'd want to hang in his operatory, in his office, would be avant-garde art. My dad was so traditional. Well, not this dentist. This dentist in 1919 was a friend of Duchamp, knew Duchamp, and was in the know about this check. He said, okay, this check is going to be worth something one day. And he kept the check and he framed it, put it in his office. And I cannot believe this. Being the daughter of a dentist, I can't believe this, but the office of the dentist in 1919 included work by Delacroix, André Durain, Maurice de Vlaeminck, Modigliani, Picasso, and Pizarro. And the Marcel Duchamp check. What is the story behind this dentist? What is the story behind a dentist that collected Picasso, Pizarro, Delacroix, Durain, Devlemnik, Modigliani. What's the story? Well, he was a Georgian, born in Georgia, in Tbilisi. His parents emigrated to France in 1880s. He became a fan of the poet and playwright Apollinaire, Guillaume Apollinaire. And Apollinaire would hang out in the coffee shops and bars of France in the late 1890s, early 1900s. And he became known for his role of the forefront of avant-garde. I mean, Apollinaire was at the forefront of the Fauvists, the Cubists, the Dadaists. And in 1923, Guillaume Apollinaire founded the Société des Amateurs d'Art and Connoisseurs. And oh my goodness, it's translated Society of Art Aficionados and Collectors. And the dentist, can you believe? The dentist Zank came along to those bars and coffee shops and was part of the groups that became the Fauvists, the Cubists, the Dadaists, this dentist. Back to the Duchamp piece that made Duchamp famous and got Duchamp kicked out of France for a while. It is a urinal toilet. It was shown at the Barbican Art Gallery in London. And now, anyway, it was created in 1917. And 2 points for anyone out there who can remember how it was signed. The urinal was signed R period Mutt, M-U-T-T, and dated 1917. Okay. What was happening with that fountain, the title of the work, Fountain? Well, this fountain created a major media buzz, and not all that buzz was positive. And then the next work of art that Duchamp made, I hope you're sitting down, was a image of Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa. And on the Mona Lisa, this is in 1919, the same date that he wrote this check. The Mona Lisa is pictured with a goatee and a signature, which it translates to read, "She has a hot ass." Okay, so
a language of the day, I tell you. So
this was the work that Duchamp created after he created the fountain, which was a real mural urinal that he stole from a men's room somewhere and signed it R. Mutt and dated it 1917. And his next work of art was an image of Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa with a goatee and the letters which spelled out "she has a hot ass" as the signatory. Many people had no idea Duchamp was such a formative artist at the time, and many people made so much fun. However, in the 60s, of course, he was rediscovered in the 1960s. And one of the things that the artist liked to do, because he was connected with the Dadaists, and you know, we have to realize the Dadaists were first and foremost poets. They were wordsmiths, and Duchamp was affected by the wordsmithing of the Dadaists, and he used to make phonetic games of some of his work. Listen to this, you know, that "she has a hot ass" that was phonetically spelled out on the bottom of the Mona Lisa. Also, the check, the dentist is named Zank. Okay, so the check is labeled Zank check. You know, when he was interviewed, when the artist was interviewed, about the sale of this zinc check to another artist, a Chilean surrealist artist, Roberto Mata, in 1944. Actually, the Duchamp himself said, I knew I was playing with words. I knew that 20 years later, it would be worth 20 times what the value was of $115 written on the check. And as a matter of fact, the original check is a promised museum by the family that owns it now, who's not actually written about, but the original check is a promised gift to the Israeli Museum in Jerusalem. There is a reproduction there that you can see, and there's also a reproduction in the collection of the M Museum in Hong Kong. What does this mean? What does this mean? Well, it means that a forged check does not always represent a financial loss, because this work is worth millions. The Zinc check is worth millions and millions and millions today.
So could I try that today?
Yeah, well, you could.
What?
You could make a blank check and see if you can, you know, I guess the value of a $115 check today, if we transpose the numbers between now and 1919, you know, you'd have to forge a check for about $20,000 and see how that looks.
Ah, okay.
I don't know how far that's going to get you. One of our stories today is the Barnes Foundation. And Richard, I don't know if you've ever been to the Barnes Foundation, but it is a one-man museum, a one-man established museum in Philadelphia. And it is still a foundation, Barnes Foundation. Mm-hmm. And it is the most eclectic museum you ever want to see. It's in his old mansion. And he was such an interesting collector. He would collect tribal masks, African masks, and hang them with masterpieces of the Impressionist period, for example. And it would be hung what we call salon style from the ceiling to the floor. And he donated it. The foundation is in aid of the students of art of Philadelphia, and he made it possible for all the students in Philadelphia for years to take tours of his mansion with this art. I remember taking a tour of the Barnes Foundation collection, and I remember seeing the school kids coming through because it was consistently open to school kids. That was Barnes' intention. There is a new show there. I don't know if you are familiar with the work Henri Rousseau. So Henri Rousseau is a 20th century self-taught artist, and he was known for his very primitive style. And he was painting right at the end of the 19th century. There is a very, very famous work of a sleeping gypsy, kind of a nomad, Egyptian nomad, and he's asleep on the sand. Above him in the painting hovers a ferocious lion, not really looking at him, but walking behind him stealthily. This was a piece by Henri Rousseau, The Sleeping Gypsy, 1897, an oil on canvas at the Museum of Modern Art, New York, gift of Mrs. Simon Guggenheim in 1939. It is now on show at the Barnes Collection as we speak. And what can we talk about Rousseau a little bit? Rousseau was an eccentric par excellence. He held a modest post in the French civil service. What did he do? He was a tax collector on goods brought into Paris. So one of the nicknames that he has in art history circles, La Douanier, which is called, it's French for the customs officer. It was an inflated title. He began as a Sunday painter. He painted in his spare hours, and eventually he painted during work, which wasn't looked upon very fondly And then he decided to exhibit a few paintings. He didn't gather much of a crowd, but he decided that he had enough money as a customs officer to retire at the age of 49. And he decided in 1893 to paint full time. And he got himself a smock and one of those hats. And he began to paint full time. And he painted huge, great big canvases in Paris at his own studio. And you've seen them. They're all large scale. They're all almost mythical. They're symbolic. They are lush jungle scenes are what he's most known for. Foliage, ripe fruit, exotic animals in the middle of Paris. It's a realist style in a funny way. But it has nothing to do with the kind of class-conscious academic style of France at the time. This is like almost childlike. It's flat. It's artificially lit. Generally, it's overfinished, unnatural colors and simple shapes. A reviewer at the time in 1890 wrote, "Monsieur Rousseau paints with his feet, with his eyes closed." The artist who submitted paintings to the salons, they were never accepted. The artist never showed at a typical venue. But there was an art show called the Society of Independence, and it was not a juried exhibition. Anybody could submit a work. And in 1890, he did submit a work, and in 1897, he included a work in the Independent Salon, this work that's at the Barnes Collection, entitled The Sleeping Gypsy. Okay, no. A female gypsy is dressed in a multicolored tunic. And as I said, she's sleeping in a desert dune. Her right arm is by her side a walking stick. And then in back of her is a lion, bigger than her. He's sniffing the air around her, it seems. And she's in a dream world. She's obviously vulnerable. There's a lion in back of her. And there's in the distance, there's like a little mountain range and a sky. And the sky is dark. There's white stars. There's a sharp moon, and the moon has a face. And it's mysterious. The painting was lost after the exhibition. So it was lost after 1897, and it wasn't found until 1923. Believe it or not, it was found at a coal dealer's, you know, somebody who would sell coal for your fireplace and for your stove. It was hidden behind a coal dealer's wall. How it got there, nobody knows. But, you know, the artist was not respected. The story of art is filled with stories like this, where something is a work of genius, but nobody really thinks it's such at its time. And so it gets squirreled away somewhere. It was found at a coal dealer's, and it was sold to a lesser, tiny little gallery. And the gallery in Paris didn't pay much for it at all, but one day Picasso stopped by. And Picasso said, "Gosh, that is fantastic," and suggested that a collector of his buy the picture. And yeah, it was rediscovered. And it returned to the art world at auction in 1926. The famous poet Jean Cocteau, a poet and playwright, who was a good friend of Picasso's, He wrote an introduction to the exhibition catalog where the painting was about to be auctioned, and it's huge. And the exhibition catalog says it's one of the most loveliest, most poetic, phenomenal, unique, the unmoving point, the fixed hub, the center of centers, where movement spins in space and spins in place, suspended, the rose at the eye of the storm, the sleep of all sleep, the silence of all silence, the sleeping gypsy of Henri Rousseau. Well, none other than Alfred Barr of the Museum of Modern Art bought the piece, and it remains in the collection today. One of the most remarkable canvases of the 19th century. And it is on view now. If you're going to Philadelphia, mark your calendars. It's on view now, The Sleeping Gypsy. And it is on view on a whole Barnes Foundation show on Rousseau called Henri Rousseau, A Painter's Secrets. It unites the two largest collections of Rousseau's painting, amassed by Alfred Barnes at the Met and by a dealer in a very famous situation who bought for the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris. And don't wait. The show was mounted the very Christmas Day this past year, 2025, and will only be up till March. So take a look at that. Now, you might say, oh, Rousseau was a scholar of foreign places and foreign myths, etc. You know, I have to tell you, Rousseau never left France. How did he picture? What was his models for his exotic locations and the flora and fauna and the wild animals? What were his models? Well, zoo taxidermy, mainly. And then sculptural pieces in Paris. A cast bronze sculpture shows a very similar lion as to the lion in The Sleeping Gypsy. And the lion has discovered the foot of a corpse buried in the sand. And a lion in Rousseau's piece looks exactly like that. And it has a look, if you look at the work of art, of it being copied from something like a sculpture. And it's characteristic of this flat style. There's no depth, there's no perspective, there's no faithful three-dimensionality. And this is usually pointed out as, oh, my kid could do that. But the avant-garde artists didn't want to be faithful to nature. And they wanted to be faithful to their own visions. You know, some of the great pieces at the Barnes collection, tigers and lions surprising their prey in the midst of jungles with their teeth bared. One is called Surprised of 1891. You know, fantastic images of places he never went, never would be, never even saw pictured. It was from his imagination. You would say, oh, well, that's surrealism at its best. However, this was before surrealism really actually was a thing. The surrealists all studied Rousseau's work, and Rousseau was an actual godfather to the surrealists, and all of his dreamlike, atmospheric canvases anticipate surrealism. André Breton, for example, Giorgio de Chirico, the manifesto, the Surrealist Manifesto of 1924, references Rousseau as the inventor, self-taught, unspoiled creativity, primitive folk art, the art of children, all of these are in defiance of what was happening in the early 20th century and the late 19th century as well. There is something to be said for a kind of a mythic psychic force in this simple tax collector Rousseau's work. You know, you look at pictures of him and you think the guy looks like a real nutcase. He's open to like wide open eyes, like he's a little bit crazy, really. And indeed, people did think that. He was, you know, miserably poor in his lifetime. He performed to buy paints as a street musician. He gave drawing lessons, even though people thought he couldn't draw. He gave violin lessons on the street. He actually tried to sell The Sleeping Gypsy. He offered it to the mayor of his hometown of Laval, France, and he wanted to ask 1,000 francs for it. And of course, the mayor turned it down. He actually was a figurehead in modern art because, and here again, the Barnes Collection show is happening. Despite a life of terrible criticism, he kept on with the faith in himself that he was a good painter. And he continued to paint in the same style, no matter how many critics ripped him apart for all kinds of things. I mean, the canvas called The Hungry Lion Throws Itself Upon an Antelope, exhibited in 1905, completely was ridiculed. Received ample ridicule, and he received the same ridicule as some of the famous people of the period, of the surrealists and of the automatic. It was called the automatic artist. Automatic, it was called because the artist would draw almost from a dream state, kind of like advanced doodling, advanced mythic kind of doodling. And so these artists, you know, Apollinaire, Gertrude Stein was a great collector. George Brock was one of the folks that, that championed Rousseau. George Brock was a huge, you know, George Brock and Picasso, huge fans of Rousseau. Just a remarkable story. So that is what's happening at the Barnes Collection in Philadelphia. Take a look if you happen to go.
Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart.
I guess we'll end with, I had a work, Richard, years ago, that I walked into a very lowly apartment, and it was a single woman who had passed away, older lady, and she didn't have much in that apartment at all. And she had a work that called to me on the wall. And I looked at it, and her daughters were there. And it really was beautiful. It was by an artist, Helen Frankenthaler, one of the most legendary female painters ever to emerge from New York, Upper East Sider, inspired by Jackson Pollock. She was what they call a color field painter, the likes of Mark Rothko, for example. And She here again, a female artist that was kind of poo-pooed at the time. Her estate was sold fairly cheaply. Well, now her work is resurfacing. There's a piece that was up at Christie's, estimated $2 to $3 million, sold for $5 million. That was just this past spring. This is an oil on canvas called Basin. A wonderful work, mainly reds, dating 1979, called Carousel. Sold for $5 million as well, Christie's this fall. Some of this, it's just remarkable. Some of this work that's surfacing of hers, because it's abstract, it's mainly colors, and it's by a female who was painting, you know, right after the painters in New York, the expressionist painters in New York. She was really a kind of a nobody, but now, my goodness, rediscovered. Like I said, 2026 is going to be the year of the rediscovery of marginal artist. She sold a piece, or a piece of, she's long gone, but a piece that she painted in 1970s, sold for $6 million fairly recently. She wanted to capture the emotional subconscious impressions lying underneath our material world. And, this was an important woman in art. Raw Fireworks, a painting she did in 1975. Another prediction of mine, the 70s is going to be a hot year in 2026. Piece sold for $8 million at Sotheby's fairly recently. And, though they continue, the prices continue to rise for these masterworks by female artists of the 70s, such as Helen Frankenthaler. And that's going to be a bellwether for 2026. You're going to see the 1970s artists, even some of the print work, reemerge. And I thank you very much, dear listeners, for all the time you've given me. And Richard, thank you very much. And here again, all the best to all of you in 2026.